So of 23 murders committed in South Australia last year, 10 were the result of domestic violence, according to Attorney General Vicky Chapman. Now the government is seeking to introduce new laws, including tougher penalties for domestic assault and increased funding for crisis centres. Joining us now is Rob Mann-Waring from Flinders University. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Nick.
Now, how will these changes make it easier to prosecute people who commit domestic violence?
Yeah, it's a good question, Nick. I mean, this last week, when the Attorney General and the Deputy Premier announced these new changes to domestic violence legislation, this came on the back of a whole suite of actually other criminal justice legislation. So the government are kind of leading on the front foot at the moment in terms of a slightly tougher law and order agenda, which is quite interesting in itself. In terms of the domestic violence legislation, there's been an ongoing reflection within the sector and more widely that there needs to be more work done. So some of the new proposals include tightening up some of the penalties and tightening up and redefining some of the offences. So one of the crucial ones is that there's going to be a new offence of the use of non-fatal force by strangulation. And this really, in one sense, is to take the onus off cases where there's significant violence, often against the women. And but in one case, it's in some cases harder to show prosecution because the threshold of intent is quite high. So basically, alluding to those 10 cases of murder that Vicky Chapman talked to last year, she's saying that a new kind of new offence of the use of non-fatal force by strangulation will, in one sense, enable the law to kind of to try and prosecute some of these men. And then, in addition, there are a few other offences being muted. So forced marriage, there's been apparently a couple of cases of women in South Australia taken out to external countries, forced to marry and then return, locking someone out of their home and taking invasive images of people without consent. And lastly, the other one that's worth flagging is that they are suggesting to increase the penalty for breach of intervention orders. And this is a really significant problem for a handful of minority, often women, that abusive partners or abusive men in their lives, where the link is severed and there are interventions, that there are repeated breaches. And this is an ongoing kind of problem that the police and other people in the sector are having to deal with. So this is the kind of suite. So overall, we're trying to see a push to tighten up some of the legislation and find new ways in to try and tackle some of this issue.
It certainly was one of the issues that the Liberals flagged in the lead-up to the election, taking action on domestic violence and also funding for crisis centres. I believe that's been increased.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's worth saying a couple of things more generally about the kind of the legislation. So generally speaking, it's probably a good move. I think it's probably welcomed by parts of the people particularly working in the sector that this is a good step. But it's worth just sort of flagging two things. Firstly, in one sense, these are, I would say, legal solutions to social problems. So the issue of domestic violence really links back to issues of gender equity. It links back to questions of patriarchy. It links back to these wider kind of social issues. And in one sense, you need a social response as well as a legal response. So yes, we should welcome the legal measures, but actually we should also talk about some of the wider social issues. So for example, if we talk about the spat that took place between David Lynholm, the Liberal Democrat senator, and Sarah Hanson-Young, for example, which was around the issue of domestic violence. At the heart of David Lynholm's offensive comments to Sarah Hanson-Young was a refusal that there is some collective responsibility in society or for men to take on board gender equity, patriarchy, and violence against women. So there's a social dynamic there. And the other thing to say is that, yes, the legislation has changed and been tightened up, and yes, it's good that there is more support for services. But actually, what about, the question is, what about dealing with men? What about primary prevention and trying to, in one sense, change social behavior in a different way? So kind of in one sense, there's always scope there to invest more in primary prevention. So this is, I would suggest, is a good welcome measure, but actually is perhaps just a legal solution to what is, I think, a social problem.
Yeah, it's a bit complex. It might be outside the realm of legislative powers to enact a great change, but yes.
That's right, and I think the issue there is that, yes, the law can be changed and tightened, and I think reflecting new changes. So, of course, particularly like the use of upskirting and mobile phone technology to for kind of, you know, offensive and behaviour, in one sense, new legislation will have to come in to kind of respond to some of that. But there's this wider question about why does it occur and are we dealing with this? Sometimes that requires actually state funding, that requires government money, that also takes government work to do this. There is a national action plan to reduce violence against women and children. There was in the previous government a kind of state plan, and the current state government have made some moves in this. But the question is, I think, that there's more to be done in this kind of wider space around tackling this as a social problem.
Well, we'll certainly keep our eye on that space. Now, on Tuesday, Premier Stephen Marshall travelled to the lands of Anangu, Pitjantjatjar and Yankunintjatjar in the state's far north to talk to local communities. It was a trip he said it would help build a stronger, more productive relationship between Indigenous communities and the government. I believe he's still up there. What do we know about how that trip has gone so far?
Yeah, it's a worth thing worth talking about. You're quite right. The Premier is up in the APY lands, and it's worth kind of reflecting on a couple of things. One is to say that my understanding is that this is the ninth trip that the Premier has made to the APY land since he's become a parliamentarian, which I think is a fairly strong signal of his interest and commitment to the kind of to building a better relationship with people with South Australia's Aboriginal people, and you know, particularly for a member of parliament who sits in a city area, that shows a strong connection. So in terms of the some of the tangibles of the visit, there's been a claim being made by the Premier that they've got agreements in place now with contractors to employ at least 30% Anangu people in the region, although we don't know how many contractors, which ones they are. But there's an effort there in one sense to improve employment outcomes. There's going to be road upgrades up there. And there's also going to be tackling some money in mobile hotspots. So there's some stuff around infrastructure there. And also he took in a visit to a local trade and training centre. And this also links to his sort of skills agenda about increasing the number of apprenticeships there. So there are some moves there taking place. And of course, in terms of social need and want there, that there are fairly strong things on there. But the thing that's to say, the main thing to kind of reflect upon this is that the Premier's approach is very different from the previous Labor government. Premier Marshall is saying that he wants practical solutions and he wants sort of a meaningful dialogue. One of the things he did very early in his leadership as Premier was to stop the talks in place of a treaty with the South Australian Indigenous people. This was something that had been kick-started under Jay Weatherill's Labor government, and a process was well underway to agreeing a treaty as part of a meaningful kind of package with Indigenous people, and Premier Marshall has stopped that. He called the treaty process a cruel hoax of a symbolism, basically saying, well, look, you're entering into this process, but actually it's not really going to change anything. But at that time, in the lead-up of the process, the commissioner of that was Professor Roger Thomas. He'd met something like 600 people, something like 280 written responses had been made as part of that treaty process, and something like 80% of those who were involved in that process meaningfully supported it. So what's very interesting is that the treaty, or sometimes actually for critics, it was also seen as more like a services agreement to improve kind of outcomes. That process has been totally stopped in its tracks by the Premier, and he's focusing on these, what he sees as these practical intents. The criticism could well be that actually this is just a bit piecemeal, and also it's not really dealing with, in a meaningful way, things like domestic violence up in those communities, and it's certainly not dealing with issues like housing as well. So this is a welcome trip by the Premier, and I think it does show his commitment to the agenda, but I think there's also a wider question here about, well, what's the best settlement or arrangement with South Australia, with its Indigenous peoples?
I did read that the general manager of the APY Council said deaths from ill health, such as renal failure and diabetes, was a major problem. Do we know if Stephen Marshall or the government's addressed any talk about health services in the region so that people don't have to travel so far away?
So far it's not been mentioned. That probably isn't to say that it's not something that they're not thinking about. But I think I'd read the same comments, and the point had been, I think, is that particularly last year, I think a significant number of deaths have taken place within the communities up there. And, of course, I guess there's an ongoing need for improved and better health access and health outcomes up there. And I guess it's a difficult area to service. It would require significant investment. So the issue is, well, what's the best kind of ways of doing this and supporting those communities up there to kind of, you know, give them better healthy outcomes? And that's not been mentioned so far as part of the Premier's agenda. He's done some Twitter clips and some videos up there, which have been kind of welcome. That's not to say it hasn't, but I think there should be a response from the government on this to say, well, what are they going to do about this?
Well, hopefully we'll hear something about that before the trip is over. Now, moving on to sort of state politics on a federal level, it's a very active time for South Australia. Mayo's going to the polls in a week and a half. I've heard you describe it as a safe non-Labor seat. What does that mean?
Yeah, this is a line I should credit to Anthony Green from the ABC. Often we see seats as safe seats, either safe Labor seats or safe Liberal seats. That's the way we tend to kind of perceive them. Mayo is rightly described as a safe non-Labor seat, meaning that the Labor Party have zero chance of actually winning that seat in any given contest. However, it's one of these handful of seats that the Liberal Party have sometimes really failed to kind of bed down. And what's kind of clear is that in certain circumstances, and we've seen this at state elections, is that when safe non-Labor seats lose to an independent or an incumbent, then actually it can be very difficult for the Liberal Party to win them back. So, of course, in Mayo, Rebecca Sharkey is the Nick Safon team, now the Centre Alliance's candidate, and polling has her in a fairly strong position to hold that, despite triggering the by-election because of her citizenship kind of issues there. So it's a very interesting seat because it looks like and feels like, in one sense, a blue-ribbon Liberal seat. But actually, once these safe non-Labor seats sometimes get their hands on a credible and competent independent, then often they're unlikely to kind of relinquish them. So we're seeing big guns go up there at the moment. So from Malcolm Turnbull, who's made at least three trips up into Mayo. Former Prime Minister John Howard has also been on the kind of campaign trail.
I think Rebecca Julie Sharkey Bishop was pouring beers as well.
That's right, the inevitable pub shot. She's been there. So, and one of the things that Georgina Downer is, in one sense, I think subtly kind of claiming, saying that, well, look, I've got links, obviously partly because steeped in family history, to the upper echelons of the Liberal Party, and I can secure influence in a way that no other candidate could do. So, in fact, when Malcolm Turnbull visited, one of the things he announced was federal funding for a new aquatic centre in Mount Barker. And and her claim would be, well, look, only a candidate like me would be able to trigger that in. Rebecca Sharkey had said, well, look, that $10 million you'd call it secured for the Aquatic Centre is something we put in as a grant previously before. It had been sitting in the federal kind of grant, sitting in the federal government grants program, and it's kind of convenient just before an election that gets kind of ticked off. So there's a sort of politicking there. The interesting issue that's kicked off there, which we should probably just mention, is around immigration, is that Georgina Downer has made some comments about immigration up there, and in one sense, spruiking kind of fears that the site Inverbracky, which was a military site, which had been used for onshore detention purposes, which caused a significant backlash by certain parts of the community up there. Downer's comments about immigration seem to be playing into this kind of immigration debate, which is really interesting, given that it's by and large a local kind of election of sorts. And Rebecca Sharkey has said that actually we should have an inquiry into data mining and the use of data by political parties, because she feels that this issue was being deliberately flagged because of the way in which political parties are using data to kind of pick on issues which they think will win them. So there's a really interesting tussle here, both about immigration and the way in which political parties are targeting kind of voters. But we would think, based on sort of polling, that Sharkey will probably hold on to the seat.
It's interesting how both candidates are focusing the spotlight on those different issues. Well, we'll be able to discuss all the ramifications with you, Rob, in a couple of weeks' time when the vote will be done and dusted. Thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast this morning.